time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy. I'm Max.
My name is Stacy Herbert. Max Kaiser, what's going on? What's the biggest news, of course? Oh, yes, is the International Swaps and Dorks Association and Derivatives Association. They have said that Greece technically defaulted. We, of course, knew all of this. Sitting on the board of this determinations committee was the likes of JP Morgan, UBS, Deutsche Bank, Bank Paribas, and Goldman Sachs. So presumably this so-called credit default swaps, the insurance products have been triggered. This is not going to be a big deal. Will we find out on Monday? What will we find?
Well, no, it's Greece. Well, a few years ago, they figured out that they had hundreds of billions of dollars in pension money that these banks wanted for their own. So they threw the country under the bus. They attacked it with financial products. Now they seize those assets, and so the banks are far richer today than they were before. I see that David McWilliams, who's a famous economist in Ireland who puts on the annual Kilconomics Festival, tweeted that the Greek economy has defaulted and the market rallied. Why did we pay Anglo-Irish the latest installment on that bond, the unsecured bond? You see, so he's quite upset, and rightfully so, that all the hoopla about this would cause Armageddon is misplaced. It's like a leverage buyout on Wall Street where a company creates a hostile raid. They take over another company. They take the assets. They take the pensions. They sell off what they can. And the Greek people, unfortunately, they are going to have to suffer a tremendous downgrade in the quality of their life. But that's the way it goes.
Unless, do you think the longed for Grexit, as I call it, for some reason, the Greek exit from the European Monetary Union will happen? And if they do leave the euro and return to the drachma, will it likely just be better for them as it ended up being better for Iceland?
Well, it's not in the interest of these bankers for Greece to leave the euro, so they're not gonna. That's not gonna happen. Just like it's not in the interest of people who own slaves. If the slaves run away from the plantation, that's not in the plantation owner's interest, is it? So that's not gonna happen.
And speaking of Iceland, I see they have their former prime minister Geir Harald on trial now for his role in the collapse of the financial system, the banking system. Prior to being prime minister, he was, of course, the head of the central bank and, oversaw the so-called deregulation that handed these three big banks to a cabal of cronies at each entity, which then proceeded to bankrupt the entire country within 5 years of deregulation. Now, the other news is that there are some people from Iceland are apparently in talks with Canada about joining the Canadian currency. And what do you think of this trend? Because, the fact is with the global Forex markets, the Forex trading, the foreign exchange trading of $4 trillion a day, it does become quite difficult for an economy that's only $13 billion annually, as is Iceland, to really have a completely stable control over their economy if all sorts of money, hot money, can flow in and out so easily.
Right, that's the incentive. And they're aware of the risk of having a currency that can be used in this way. And, the bigger picture is the trend away from the dollar. Mm-hmm. So on the same week, you also had news that China is aggressively marketing the yuan to BRIC nations. Brazil, Russia, India, China, they're trying to do more and more deals with BRIC nations and get the yuan circulating in the BRIC nations and away from the dollar. So the dollar is losing its primacy as reserve currency. 70% of all transactions in the world were based in dollars a few years ago. That number is down to 60% or so. So it's losing every month, every quarter, every year, less and less. Global trade is done in dollars, and that is the big trend. And you know, Iceland just represents this. They didn't want to make their krona convertible in U.S. dollars. You know, they're looking for Canadian dollars or anything but U.S. dollars, because the U.S. dollar is perceived as not being all that stable.
Well, yeah. I always find it interesting when the likes of Joe Wiesenthal say gold and silver are unstable. I say, what do you mean, priced in dollars? Which are the ones that are, if you look at the chart of the dollar over the 10 years, it's been wild gyrations. The other big story is, well, there have been a number of them. So we asked on the latest Kaiser report, one of the episodes this past week, why Rupert Murdoch, why John Corzine, why other hackers such as this have not been arrested and have not been presented with charges that will see them in prison for 122 years, as these LulzSec hackers alleged have been arrested in the past week and face 122 years in prison, at least the American ones. From what I can tell, the crimes that the likes of Sabu did seem no different from the crimes that Rupert Murdoch's organization committed against thousands of people here in the UK.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it, that Murdoch, News Corp hacked into thousands and thousands of people, and really in a way that was disruptive. You know, somebody had just lost their child, or war people, or 9/11 victims, and so this is just a matter for the courts to kind of futz around with for a number of years. But this this other case of a cyber hacker who was causing no appreciable damage is met with 100-year prison term. I mean, clearly, there's that two-tier justice system all over the world now. And so there is no justice. You can't have a two-tier justice. You either have justice or no justice. And having a two-tier system is the same as having no justice at all. And this is something that people are responding to more and more. And, you know, you mentioned Murdoch. And it's interesting that, you know, in America, you know, let me reframe it. In the UK, they have a left wing and a right wing. You know, the left wing is Labour. And they sit on the left in the House of Commons, and then you have the right wing. They're the right wing people, and they're conservatives, and they have their own newspapers, and they talk conservative talking points. And then there's the left wing and the Labour, and they talk their talking points. And there's this, you know, left right divide, and nobody seems bothered by it. I mean, that you're going to have a debate, and you might as well have a debate and identify yourself, you know, as either the red team or the blue team or the one team or the other team. You can't just have a debate and not have, you know, opposing views. But in America, because it's a nation of a strange nation, that right-left divide is gone, doesn't exist anymore. They have what's now called the culture wars. And in the culture wars, which is just a renaming of the right-left divide, on the right, they're taking tremendous losses. They had this guy, Andrew Breitbart, died recently. He was a right-wing pundit. Rush Limbaugh, who's a right-wing radio talk show host, is being censored. Like Glenn Beck was taken off the air, people getting rid of their ads on his show. Christopher Hitchens became a right-wing spokesman in America. He died recently. So the whole, and Murdoch, of course, is a right-wing guy. All these people are on the defensive now. So the whole right-wing talking machine, plus the GOP Republican primaries are just generating not very credible alternative to the current Obama administration. But it's interesting that I think we're at a 40 or 50 year cycle change. You know, the 60s and the 70s were left wing in America. You had the Black Panthers, you had civil rights, you had women's rights, gay rights, black freedom rights. Yeah, all these things came along. That was the left. Then you had Reagan. That was the right. And now it appears as though the pendulum is going left again.
Yeah, but in the 60s and 70s, we actually had habeas corpus and due process and the and, you know, ancient rights, human rights. We don't have those anymore. They've been abolished. And as of March 1st, the U.S. president can assassinate any American citizen they want. So we'll see, because there aren't very many progressives in America at the moment. They have to hit bottom, I think. They're, you know, in general, filled with hate for their neighbors and support oligarchy because they are in a red team, blue team hyper-partisanship. So, you know, most fans of, say, Man United don't care if somebody on their team cheats and gains a goal unfairly against Arsenal because it's, you know, it's they want their side to win. And the same here. So I don't know. With no rights and with the fact that the Supreme Court, who, you know, the corporations scream as being activists, if they give any sort of human rights, endow humans with any rights, the Supreme Court decided last year or the year before, was it the Citizens United case, where now not only do corporations have the rights of humans, but they have unlimited rights, unlike most humans in America who, say, can only donate, what is it, like $3,500 to any presidential candidate. Corporate humans can donate unlimited amounts.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, as you say, they have to hit bottom before there's a significant, you know, change of direction. And, yeah, they might be hitting bottom now, and it could be the beginning of a 30, 40-year cycle. So we're not going to see anything meaningful for 5 or 10 years in terms of getting back to some of the things you mentioned, like habeas corpus and other things on the agenda. And that, of course, won't come without, you know, what we saw in the 60s was a lot of unrest.
Yeah, you know, I actually saw a chart. They were saying how much, you know, is being spent on the presidential campaign. And they were looking at times in the past as a percentage of U.S. GDP, which were the most expensive campaigns. And the one in, I think it was 1896, was actually like 10 times more expensive than the last presidential election. So apparently in the late 1800s, there were some very, a lot of heavy money involved in these campaigns. I know your family also, Hugh Maxwell, had put in Garfield, I think it was, right before Abe Lincoln, the guy before Abe Lincoln. So, I mean, there was like a lot of heavy, you know, a lot more money spent at a certain point in U.S. history on elections.
Well, I think it was William Jennings Bryan was involved in that election season. And, of course, he was arguing for a bimetal, gold and silver. He felt that America was going to die on a cross of gold. He wanted to bring silver in as well to expand the money supply. And I think that this was the beginning of major lobbying efforts that resulted in the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank, which was the third attempt of to bring in a national bank as such. So the corporations, of course, are very interested in that type of thing, and they were spending lots of money.
Yeah, you're right. It was William McKinney versus William Jennings Bryan who lost. It's a campaign considered by political scientists to be one of the most dramatic and complex in American history.
Yeah, it was a turning point for sure. And for those of you that follow the history of gold and silver and hard money versus fiat money, you know, of course, it wasn't too much. After that, they had the meeting on Jekyll Island a few years later, where they determined the organization of the Federal Reserve Bank, which they did not call it the central bank, because I knew the word central bank would be sound wrong to the American ear. That was against any central planning. So they call it instead the Federal Reserve Bank, and which is acts as a central bank, however, and it's the beginning of central planning in the banking sector, which has carried us almost 100 years now into this fiat money history. And what we're seeing now in the last few years is the end of the line in terms of the amount of growth that you can generate by printing money and creating debt. So 50 years ago, during the 70s, the 60s or 70s, where the left was active, for every dollar in debt you created in the federal government, you could create a dollar of GDP growth. Today, recently, it takes $5 or $6 or $7 of debt to be created to create the same GDP growth. Of course, it's hard to determine now because so many trillions of the debt is held off the balance sheet in dark exchanges and dark pools and off balance sheet vehicles and in the global derivatives exchange. And, you know, getting back to Greece, they let Greece default after they expanded the European Central Bank's balance sheet from under half a trillion euros to over 3 trillion euros. Remember, Greece was a $400 billion economy, so they could euthanize it as they've done over the past 2 years and wind it down to being worth, on paper anyway, nothing, but absorb all that through this 3 trillion euro ECB credit facility now. That'll just be the mechanism to refinance Greece. They added another 30 billion euros in debt. That was the solution, as it always is. They treat a debt problem by repackaging all the debt, but expanding it, creating more debt, and extending the terms of maturity. So it's extend and pretend, as they say. And they've done this again to Greece. They will re-default, as that term is understood, probably in 2 years from now. But the country is now basically been annexed by a few bankers, and sovereignty has been lost, and the same fate awaits a few other countries.
I thought you were going to say they were going to default in 2 months, no, not 2 years.
No, 2 years.
Well, I see Germany is calling for to not maybe redraw, but they want to have a discussion about the EU constitution and to give certain nations more power than they currently have and to allow for EU monitors, presumably German and Dutch, perhaps, monitors to go monitor other nations and see how they are conducting themselves in terms of fiscal and monetary and economic policy.
Well, it's a money spinner. Greece is a money spinner for Germany. They'll have a cut of all the activity that goes on in Greece, all the shipping, all the tourism, everything that comes in and out of Greece, they're going to get their cut. So it's a huge money spinner. It's like a buy-to-lent program in the UK. I mean, they bought it and they're renting it out to tourists and shippers and other and Greek people themselves. The Greek people themselves now are renters in their own country. They used to own the country. Now they're basically renters in the country. Many of them will leave. The economy was revised. Instead of contracting 9% last quarter, it contracted 9.5%. The economy will continue to shrink, but it still generates cash flow in terms of shipping, tourism, infrastructure, roads, telecommunications, and a piece of that income now goes to Germany and the bankers that were instrumental in collapsing the economy for this exact moment. It has worked perfectly for the banking leverage buyout or private equity groups.
Well, there you go. I see another report is out. Here's the Telegraph today. The H-Boss horror story is a grim read. Britain's financial crisis was really a tale of two banks, Royal Bank of Scotland and H-Boss, the owner of Halifax. And this is what it always comes down to, of course, is a tale of two banks or three in Iceland, one in Ireland, two in France. You know, it's always one or two run by a cabal of guys, usually engaged in wide scale fraud, just outright fraud. You know, I saw a headline from yesterday that countrywide loan officer faces 15 years prison, is sentenced to 15 years prison for fraud. And I thought, oh my God, finally, like 15 years for an executive at Countrywide, the largest subprime mortgage lender in the US. Nope. It was just some woman who worked there. She was a loan officer and she had profited. She had set up dummy people to, dummy buyers for homes and given them loans for more than the house was worth and pocketed the money. So she was, so they actually, you know, you find these low hanging fruit are the ones starting to go down. Whether or not we'll ever get above the clerk level, we don't know.
Yeah, well, that's right. So you have the grifters and the nickel and dime scammers get caught up and create a headline that somehow they're going after financial crime, but they're not.
Well, here in the UK, the HBOS story, the first story has been told in pedantic detail by the Financial Service Authority in a 450-page report on the failure of RBS. Today, the FSA released the first chapter of the second tale and painted an even more damning picture. HBOS's mistakes were simpler than the complicated books of toxic assets and acquisition errors at RBS. HBOS has failed because it had terrible corporate governance. See, that's what they use for a crime at the upper levels. It's just bad corporate governance. In MF Global case, they're blaming it on lax back office, you know, paperwork. The next excuse here offered by the FSA, a neutered risk control function and an odd personality cult around a rather quiet Scottish banker. Now, you see personality cults, however, at every single one of these banks that crash down. You know, everybody, you know, creates these cults around people who are rich, whether it's Bernie Madoff or Jamie Dimon. They think that, you know, the guy is rich. They develop a cult around him, and they don't realize that it's the cult-like behavior towards them which enables them to be rich by fleecing you.
Yeah, well, sure, Fred Goodwin at Royal Bank of Scotland. And, you know, they had the vision to commit crimes on an epic scale. And that was the beauty of it all. He's a visionary. You know, he saw that you could fleece the system for hundreds of billions of dollars, not just a few thousand quid. And, you know, he got a knighthood for it. And then they stripped him of his knighthood. And but he's by and large untouched by the legal system. Same thing for the guys over at Anglo-Irish or any of these other big banks. And here's the thing, though. The crimes that will be reported in 2 years' time and then revealed as a story that you're just talking about now, because remember, these are crimes from Royal Bank of Scotland that were committed 5 years ago. And now they have a story. Wow, these crimes 5 years ago were really bad. Now, right today, there are bankers in these same countries, the UK, the United States, and other countries around the world that are committing crimes as heinous as these crimes. But they're not being reported today, except for us. We report on them because it's not hard to figure out what they're doing, and we talk about it. And then in a few years from now, they'll decide that after the system crashes again, as it will, of course, then they'll try and say, well, what happened? Then they'll say, well, what about the crime that happened in March of 2012 when so-and-so was committing this massive fraud at a bank? And they'll talk about some story that we talked about on this show. And then they'll say, well, we really need to go after the guy. And then the guy at the bank will say, well, you better not, because we're systemically wedded to the functioning of your system. And if you try to prosecute us, we're going to crash the entire system. Then that'll go on for a couple of years. Then the statute of limitations will expire. Then it'll be too late to go after them. Then they'll have a story like you're just reading about Royal Bank of Scotland 5 years ago or 7 years ago. And the cycle just repeats itself because there is no deterrent for committing financial fraud, and the price of borrowing money on the wholesale market to perpetrate fraud is just way too low.
Well, that's right. But, we were talking to Chris Martinson, who will be on the next On the Edge, not this Saturday, not today's, but next Saturday's. And he was forecasting a rise in interest rates starting to happen, starting with Japan. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that?
Right. Well, that's what that and Chris Whalen, we talked about Chris Whalen about the same thing, that eventually The only way to get these banks out of this deflationary spiral, paradoxically enough, is to start raising interest rates, because then banks have an incentive to lend money to each other. And then that opens up the credit cycle and the multiplicity of money kicks in and you start to see real inflation. Right now, that's not happening. And so there's too much money to be made in the carry trade of having 0% interest rates and then lending it back to the central bank at 2 or 3%. But in the case of Japan, which was already in a 20-year deflationary nightmare, then suffered Fukushima. Over 50 of their nuke plants went offline. Energy costs are now skyrocketing. So the country could be the first of the G20 countries to take the very bold step of beginning to raise interest rates. And then you have, you know, game theory kicks in, the prisoner's dilemma kicks in. And the yen would then be a desired currency because it starts to pay an interest rate. Interest rate differentials start to matter. And then people start raising interest rates again. And the cycle reverses. And I think the two cycles are, the political cycle and interest rate cycle might be wedded here, tied at the hip. Because for the 25, 30 years post-Reagan of easy money, you had the Republican criminals in charge. During this now raising interest rates of a recession depression, it will probably be the populist and, the people in charge, people would normally associate with the left.
Yeah, but of course the left means a lot of foreigners have to die, because the left are very they believe humanitarian intervention, but which ends up in lots of dark or Muslim or brown or other people dying. And you see that over and over with, Jimmy Carter and Indonesia. You know, we saw the beginnings of the whole Suharto regime, the slaughter of the East Timorese. You saw that with Bill Clinton, and you see that now, definitely over the last few years, led by Tony Blair. And of course, people have started a hashtag Tony2012. Let's see him brought to the Hague, because yes, Joseph Kony is wanted by the International Criminal Court, along with several other black people, but there are no white people on the list. But we're trying to, some people are trying to put Tony Blair on that list, because he is responsible for the death of more children than Joseph Kony ever killed. And people are trying to put him on there.
You know, we saw that film, Iron Lady, about Margaret Thatcher, which is kind of interesting. But, there was a film a couple of years ago by Roman Polanski, The Ghostwriter, that was obliquely about Tony Blair, if I recall.
Yeah.
About a prime minister who commits a lot of heinous acts in office.
And he's actually a CIA agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a really underrated film, I thought. It was done kind of in a Hitchcock style. And really well done, and good story. Ewan McGregor played a journalist and was writing a book in there. He did a good job. And the guy who I think always plays Tony Blair played Tony Blair again. That guy who was in all these movies about Tony Blair. And
he is basically Tony Blair.
Mm-hmm. He's always the guy. And it's a good movie. It's a good film. But yeah, Blair, it's no secret that he's a really dirty guy and tied to the oil industry and making a bundle after leaving the prime ministership. And sure, it'd be great to see him go to The Hague and meet a tribunal. That'd be fantastic, right?
Well, speaking of London, there was another Kaiser Report episode that I thought was pretty interesting, is that Shark Boy and Lava Girl episode 259. And, talking about commodities and futures markets, we saw Grand Theft futures market in MF Global. And Shark Boy and Lava Girl are apparently the nicknames for Blythe Masters and Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan, because they're commodities desk has performed 3.8 billion or 1.2 billion more than Goldman Sachs's. $1.2 billion, of course, happens to be the amount that has been missing from MF Global clients and from their commodity funds, their segregated commodity funds. And we point that out in the episode. I thought that would have got more attention, that we pointed out that $1.2 billion magical win that JP Morgan had. They're boasting about having earned $1.2 billion more than Goldman Sachs, and that happens to be the amount that they had transferred from MF Global segregated accounts to them. But it all happens here in London. It's, you know, Blythe Masters, this British woman who runs the commodities desk for JP Morgan, and then Isabel Ellet, who runs, she's also British out of London, and runs the Goldman Sachs commodities trading.
Yep, London is the epicenter for all the big time financial fraud. That's the business model. That's what Cameron wants to protect. But I, you know, I think people are becoming a bit bank scandal fatigued out at this point. And also they are captured now by the rise of technology and these IPOs for Facebook and these other social networking sites. And there's a venture capital firm that has now moved over the Atlantic and is in the UK sponsoring a huge new music networking startup site. So all of the startup mania that we see in America with all these startup, hundreds of startup companies and billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, Apple opening a headquarters and a new big facility in Austin, Texas. You know, this technology wave is really the story of the year right now. So there hasn't been a market crash of significance in a while. The banking story, you know, people are got bank criminal fatigue. And so MF Global, billions stolen, you know, it's just not getting the attention because the news cycle and window has, I think, moved.
Yeah, well, there's also, from what I can tell from, you know, the 1,000 people I follow on Twitter and looking at other retweets and stuff like that, is there's a real urgency by, you know, well-meaning Westerners to, they want to have more, they definitely want Ugandans to be murdered. There was an urgency to go kill Libyans. They're, now that's assuaged. They definitely want to send troops and bombs and stuff to Syria now. So there's a lot of that sort of vengeance, that need for vengeance and retribution seems to be fulfilled constantly. Like we're constantly bombing a new nation over the last year. Not only have we had the continuing operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, we also are bombing Yemen, Somalia, Uganda, you know, where we're operating in Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. We bombed Libya. Now we're going into Syria. So, I mean, there's a, you know, these are very passionate engagement by, I notice a lot of people on Twitter, they're very passionately engaged with the need to go alter these people's lives.
I mean, it seems like the U.S., U.K. are in just about every country in the world now. Every country that they thought posed any kind of threat is being occupied in some way, except for Iran. Iran is the last holdout, I guess. And, you know, that seems to be something that they're going to be focusing on before the end of the year as well. So where is there any country in the Middle East or in Africa that is not part of this wave, this post 9/11 wave of global occupation? Seems pretty comprehensive at this point.
Well, I maintain it's definitely peak credit, peak debt meets peak resources. You know, it's not an accident that they're all happening at the same time. We can't pay off all our debts. You know, you need resources to grow the economy, no matter what we say. Even Apple, even you know, Microsoft, all these software companies cannot run without resources. They need precious metals. They need rare earths. They need, you know, cobalt and titanium and coltan or whatever that one is from the Congo. So, you know, we need these things and we need them now and cheap. And we, you know, I think they're all connected.
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned Apple, and it's certainly a good proxy for this whole thing. You know, 10 years ago, the company is worth $10 billion. Now it's worth $500 billion. It's the most valuable company in the world. And right at the stock price the way it is now, there's no trouble on the horizon, no trouble obtaining the rare earths, no trouble with the supply chains, no trouble getting the energy. No trouble. They've got $100 billion in cash. They're bigger than most countries of the earth at this point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you use Apple as a proxy, then the American business model of conquest is on target, doing great. People are buying Apple products all over the world. You know, all these countries that America is in now, they sell them Apple products. They open McDonald's and Starbucks. You got Kraft Foods. It's now got Oreo cookies and green tea ice cream flavors in China and, you know, in all countries around the world and their local adaptions of these classic American products. And the technology story is booming. And the NASDAQ's over 3,000 stock markets that are near an all-time high. So the narrative is, you know, one of boom, boom.
Yeah, well, it's all seeming to go bizarrely according exactly to the plan laid out in the policy for a new American century, and it looks like they are definitely succeeding. I mean, this is the plan from Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush. They wrote the policy for a new American century. Paul Wolfowitz, it was published in 1997, 98, somewhere around there. They gave it to Bill Clinton, and in this policy for a new American century, they were arguing why he needed to invade Iraq, and the reason wasn't necessarily to secure their oil resources directly, like take the oil, but it was in order to prevent China from doing any deals and any competition to the U.S. emerging for real. So if China always has to buy their oil essentially through the toll booth of the U.S. military machine, the U.S. military machine and military industrial complex can control who their competition is.
Well, you know, China for 20 years was where inflation went to die, you know, because wages there were so ridiculously cheap. Now, wages in China are up 25-30% 2 years in a row, mm-hmm. and look like they're going to be rising 25% a year for the next 5 to 10 years. So the inflation genie is coming back out of the bottle in a big way. And so this will be kind of the financial story going forward, will be this grinding inflation. So in the UK, the cost of petrol in pound terms hit an all-time high recently. So people are getting squeezed with the price of energy, price of food. All these things are squeezing them out of the middle class in a lot of ways. You know, they're finding a lot of problems there. So this is, I think, maybe not going to have the crash so much as an inflationary melt-up.
Well, you know, we're talking about these all these peoples and nations being conquered, especially if they have any resources below them. Like Uganda, for example, just discovered 2.5 billion barrels of oil in 2006. It's not yet online, but it's also interesting that it's supposed to come online. The oil is supposed to be start producing in the next year. So it is quite curious that we, you know, we found our Western sort of the white man's burden suddenly found interest again in Uganda, and we must protect, you know, with using a very old story, this Joseph Kony story, for example. The guy has left 6 years ago, but suddenly we're interested in the crimes he committed a decade ago. But there is one success story in the past week about this whole resource wars, and that's Japan recalls its whaling fleet from the Southern Ocean. Japan's fishery agency has told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the country's whaling fleet is heading home after catching less than a third of its quota in the Antarctic. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Group, which harassed the fleet in the Antarctic, says it's a massive victory for whales. Despite receiving a special budget boost of $31.9 million US dollars to fend off the Sea Shepherd, the Japanese whalers were repeatedly obstructed by the activists. The Australian government says it welcomes Japan's decision to recall its whaling fleet from the Southern Ocean.
Yeah, big success there for a sea shepherd. And this is a fantastic success story. And that's a great show on Animal Planet. They have the Whale Wars, Captain Paul Watson and the Sea Shepherds. And the Japanese whaling fleet was sent home. And this is a tremendous victory.
Yeah, well, it's also, you know, very rare to see young activist Westerners down there really laying their lives on the line. I mean, because it, you know, they've so far gone home safely at the end of it, everyone. But those are very dangerous waters that they're, you know, ramming ships with. There, mm-hmm. it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, they've been in some really precarious situations, and they've all been safe so far, which is fantastic. And so now the whalers are going to go home for the season. And how much longer can they even try to go out there and whale? At some point, they may just have to abandon whaling.
Yeah, I guess it also is a matter of pride, or, you know, the Japanese government seems to have an endless amount of money, for example, to sustain their, you know, the U.S. dollar. You know, they'll buy, what, $300 billion annually of U.S. Treasury bills. What's $32 million to go fight some whalers?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting war zone. You know, it's all about ships out there, ships, captains versus captains. You know, they don't use drones. They don't use this other type of modern technology. It's more of a maritime, ancient, you know, maritime tactics, really. And so Captain Paul Watson is just a superior captain, and he's beaten the Japanese captains.
Well, now let's see if they'll take it to the next level and go to Africa and try to protect the rhinos and do hand-to-hand combat with the, you know, the Chinese, you know, hiring the Africans to go, you know, cut the horn off a rhino. Mm-hmm. So that's the next, because those are the, you know, that's the end of the line for the certain species across Africa.
Yeah, well, they are, Sea Shepherd is, I know they do other campaigns for dolphins and things. Mm-hmm. So they are doing other things in the various oceans. They're in the Mediterranean doing something. And, well, you know, Paul Watson, you know, he makes a big point of the fact that he was one of the co-founders of Greenpeace, but he decided that he needed to get more confrontational with the whaling fleets out there and go out there to the whaling grounds and really take them on out there in the oceans instead of trying to campaign you know, bureaucratically, and to sue, do a lot of lawsuits and things. And you know, he's been doing this for a long, long time. And, you know, this methodology that he's, that even if someone were to, at this point, get injured, you know, I mean, it would still be now after this very, very significant victory. So he has made it across the certain threshold of accomplishment, I would say, proving that direct action is a very effective means to protect Earth.
You know, I was going to say, oh, but speaking of the whaling thing, I mean, those are in international waters, but in the last few weeks, you know, the U.S. is passing this new law where you're not allowed to be an animal rights activist regarding factory farming. Mm-hmm. It's now, I don't know what the sentence is, but assuming, you know, it's in line with all the other U.S. anti-activist laws. There are, you know, for example, environmental activism is considered an act of terrorism under the U.S. Patriot Act. Is it as extreme as those sentencing guidelines, which is like up to 30 years? So if you go into a factory farm, they say if you got a job there in order to film the abuse, mm-hmm. You know, that's fraud and felony and, like, you know, extreme U.S. style sentences for it.
Right. Well, they're afraid of competition. They don't want anyone competing in the open market, the free market. They want to have a monopoly, a prison model where people are forced to live without rights and eat what's thrown in on their plate. You know, they don't have any choice about it. And that's a profitable business. And the corporate interests are trumping all civil rights interests, and that trend is continuing pretty aggressively in the United States for sure.
Okay, well, you know what? We're going to end this a little bit early because it's my birthday weekend, by the way. If you want to send me a birthday present, you can send it to the North Pole.
How much early?
It's 5 minutes early.
That's not fun.
You don't want to? Okay, then what do you want to talk about? I was going to go prepare
for... can mention that Pirate My Film has had another successful week. In the past week, we got financed. Another project has gotten the financing, in the process of getting financing. This is a very interesting project about the insider trading surrounding the events of 9/11. So it's a German investigative journalist who has done a lot of work in this area. He raised money on Pirate My Film to work on a translation into English of, I guess, a film that he's done in, it's in German. And there's a lot of excitement around it. This is still an interesting story because it ties together use of markets to around various military events or political events or high profile bombings and hijackings and things. There's a lot that goes on in the markets around these events. Certainly around 9/11, there was a lot of options trading leading up to those events. And so this is going to – it's a very – so he's now collecting the funds. So that'll be out in the marketplace. Then another project successfully raised money to do an animation about Bitcoins. So that'll be in the market soon. Then Terry Boole, who we interviewed on the Kaiser Report, she's in the process of raising money for a story about sex scandals in the hedge fund industry in Connecticut, which sounds pretty darn interesting. In light of this new prostitution ring, and that implicates Morgan Stanley in Manhattan, is connected probably, and
with another British woman, by the way, they're all commodities trader, and there's a certain commodity that's been a commodity sold for a long time, thousands of years, and this British woman was the madam there for the Morgan Stanley bankers.
Yeah, men are simple. Men are easy to manipulate, that's for sure. And let's see, what else we got on the Pirate My Film? We got projects being listed every day, new projects, very exciting. Next year, we're going to have to go down to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, and talk about it, I think, or that'd be a good place for it. Meet up with Alex Jones down there, see how he's doing. The Alex Jones information wars. There's a war on for your mind, you know, Stacey.
Well, you know, speaking of Pirate My Film and self-financing and independently making your own content and young artists and things like that, we also covered the story this past week, which was about Streetlight Manifesto, and they have a deal with Victory Records. But if here's a young artist group, young rock and roll stars. Their YouTube videos have well over 1 million views each, but they're receiving no money. They've received no money from their record labels. Apparently, it's of course always. There's always some accounting trick to never pay the artists, despite all of the propaganda, despite all the, you know, national support given to the fact that we must lock up young illegal downloading kids for 30, 40 years so that, you know, young artists can survive. Well, they're saying they actually don't receive any money. So they're asking people to boycott their record label, don't buy their albums from there, but instead go to their own website and buy the music there, or will buy their products like t-shirts, caps, and stuff like that. And we're interviewing them for next, in like 10 days, next Tuesday.
Yeah, it's part of this whole P2P revolution and the anonymous group and the crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, social networking, all this activity that's going on. In the face of the copyright cartel. So you've got anti-ACTA, anti-SOPA, anti-PIPA. People are waking up to the dangers of having perpetual copyright. I was talking to a musician the other day, and they were saying, well, why can't I own my song? I own my property, my house. It's the same thing. You know, but it's not the same thing. What? Because
you respond so quickly.
It's not the same thing because there's no clear title chain on a song. You know, no musician can claim authorship of a song solely. It's all based on remixing. Whereas a house, you can clearly identify who the previous owners were. But with a song, you can't identify a previous owner. So it's immoral and unethical and makes no sense to give a monopoly value beyond a very short window of maybe 20 or 30 years. Beyond that, it just screws up the public domain where all the ideas are to be mixed and remixed, and it's counterproductive to society, and it's counterproductive to any kind of benefit of society or anyone living in the society.
You know, speaking of fundamentalism, where fundamentalists offer selective readings of certain texts, whether it's the Bible or Adam Smith, in America, there's a lot of selective reading of Milton Friedman. And I did just read you an interview with him from 2002, where he is totally against onerous copyright laws because he believes that copyright is not like property rights. Despite what the propaganda is now, he was saying that it's an artificial monopoly creating artificial scarcity when it's that it's more important that ideas flow freely. But now we truly must go celebrate Stacey Herbert's birthday. You know, for women, birthdays are like 3, 4, 5 day events.
And they come every 5 or 6 years.
No.
No? How else could you end up being 29 years old?
Oh, I get it. I get it. I get it. That's so cute. Well, you know, a truth about markets would not be a truth about markets, particularly at the end of the show, if it were not for Max Keiser saying,
bye, y'all.